Welcome to the Armani Talk Show, episode 15. I'm your host, Armani Talks. Join me as we talk about a variety of different topics ranging from public speaking, storytelling, emotional intelligence, and much more. If you're listening from YouTube, go ahead and hit that subscribe button, hit that bell notification. I drop a new Armani Talk Show the first day of every month. If you're listening from podcast, go ahead and keep listening. And once you're done, leave me a review on your podcast provider of choice. And if you're listening from X, Twitter, whatever they call it nowadays, then just go ahead and retweet it whenever you get the chance. Now, with that being said, let's get started off with today's episode. I want to start off in a topic that often gets confused with one another. The phrase, hobbies, talent, skills, many think that they're the exact same thing. Or at most, they think talent and skill, that's the same thing, and hobbies are something radically different. What do you think? Do you have an opinion on the matter? I'm here to tell you that all three are different, and it's important that you understand the difference, because once you do, you are one step closer to finding your calling. Let's get started off with hobbies. What exactly are those? Hobbies are anything that you are naturally curious about, and you would participate in this activity, whether you got paid or not. We all have hobbies, okay? And before I talk about all these examples and stuff, let me just iron out the differences among all of these, and then we will talk about examples. So hobbies are typically led with curiosity. Skills, on the other hand, are led with rules. What kind of rules? The type of rules that will benefit society. Now, at this point, you may see something a little different between hobbies and skills. Hobbies, there seems to be a certain level of joy with it. While with skills, wait a minute, Armani, you're talking about rules? Rules don't seem to be fun. Yes, it's not always fun. So to turn a hobby into a skill, it requires work and it requires a level of professionalism. I'll actually give you an example real quick. Imagine that you are someone that is just curious about music. You love to play the guitar. If you're playing the guitar in your room, then that is a hobby. That is something that is only providing value to yourself. But the second that you get a camera and you begin recording yourself playing the guitar, you're trying to get better so you can impress your audience and give the audience value where they have good music to listen to, you have officially started the journey of turning a hobby into a skill. Talents are somewhat different because every single time I try to describe what exactly is a talent, I am led to something metaphysical. The top performers within any field, they traditionally say stuff like, man, I'm just God gifted at this, man. It's just a gift. It was bestowed upon me. And I'm thinking, wait, I thought you worked on this. And they're like, well, yeah, I mean, in the skill level, I worked on it. But even prior to that, I always had a gift for this. LeBron James will say something like, God bless me with great genes. I mean, not everyone is 6'8" and just picks up muscle so easily like LeBron. Jay-Z said, I mean, I've always had this gift for rapping. I understood rhythms, beats, lyrics. And you could even say that a lot of the gifts that you're bestowed upon, it can come from where you are raised. So Jay-Z was raised in a music household. So that cultivated his rapping skill sets from a very early age. So the talent aspect, a lot of the times we are just born with something that we are great at. Now, this is where things can get tricky. Whenever you are born with something, every now and then you may grow to resent this something. In undergrad, I remember our fraternities and the different organizations out there, they had a thing called strolling. This was when different fraternities and sororities would do this rhythmic dance to represent their organization. Now, there was this one guy who was the master of strolling. They actually called him the king of strolling because he was so freaking good. He could watch a move once and he could easily replicate it and make it better. Where other people, they needed to watch it 10 times, practice it for 2 weeks to even pull the move off. This guy was a savant, the king of strolling. It came easy to him. And it came so easy to him that eventually different organizations were pretty much volunteering his services to their organizations. They're like, Mr. King of Strolling, you're going to come to our chapter and teach the new generation how to stroll like you. And he's like, okay, I mean, I was going to do something else this weekend, but yeah, I mean, I guess I'll come and teach the new generation. He does it once. This organization begins talking about how the King of Strolling is such a great teacher. It starts recommending his services to other people. And now the King of Strolling is teaching different organizations. And he somewhat begins to resent the skill just a little bit because others consider him a great teacher, but he finds it annoying to teach. He's thinking, why is it so difficult for you? It's easy for me. How come you can't pick it up as quickly as I can? The King of Strolling has not taken much time to turn this talent into a skill. He doesn't know about the history of strolling. He doesn't really understand why people do certain moves the way that they do it. He doesn't understand how to practice for a set routine. He's just born with this greatness. And eventually, this King of Strolling guy, he grows to resent strolling, and he's just like, man, I hate it, bro. I don't want to ever go to another stroll event again. So he started off strong, but he fizzled out rather quickly. On the flip side, though, there was another funny thing that was going on. The funny thing was that there were a lot of these chubby guys that loved to stroll. Soon as they became a fraternity member, they started to go to every single stroll practice because they felt as though strolling was a great vehicle for their creative expression. So they're starting to go to all these different practice sessions, and after each session, they still suck. They're too fat. No offense. They don't have rhythm. They run out of breath a little too quick. So despite them being very curious about strolling, they're just not that good. Now, what are you learning about this right now? What are these fat people? Do they have a hobby for strolling, or do they have a talent for strolling? They have a hobby. Despite them sucking right now, they're still putting in extra hours to learn about the history of strolling. They're learning about the different moves. They keep going to the practice sessions. This is their hobby. And eventually what happens is that they're learning more and more of the rules. They're getting better. Still not that great though, but they're getting better. And eventually, here's what would happen with a lot of these fat guys. They would strategically be used for comedic purposes. Because there were a lot of things called stroll competitions, and the audience can just watch a bunch of dudes dancing for so long, right? I mean, they're dancing in harmony. I get it. It's cool. Now what? So eventually the audience gets bored. And this is when these organizations would bring out the fat members from their squad, and the fat members would break out of the harmonious motion and do a pattern interrupt. They'd suddenly start doing something goofy and funny. And the audience is like, whoa, what is this? What is this guy doing? This is funny. It's different. They start laughing. They're reeled back into the performance. And all the other brothers go back to dancing again. So this thing was very unique because a lot of the cool brothers, the brothers with a lot of the talent, they didn't want to do something goofy on stage like that. But the fat guys, because they had such a strong hobby for this particular field, they were willing to do whatever it took. And due to them willing to do whatever it took, eventually what happened was that they discovered their own lane and they stayed strolling way longer than a lot of these talented people. So that's something you got to learn. A lot of the times, there are people that do not have the talent, but they are so freaking curious about this particular field that they will themselves into learning the skills. And despite them still not having that raw talent, they're able to still carve out a lane for themselves. You want to know when to throw in the towel, though. Because if you're one of these, let's say 5'4" guys and you're dreaming to be in the NBA, you could do it. I'm not saying you can't, but you got to also be realistic. If you're, let's say, a 34-year-old guy that's 5'4" and you want to make it into the NBA and you lack skills, you're not even that tall, so you can't block shots easily, you got to be somewhat realistic. This is not a talented field for you. You could learn some skills, but what are you going to really do? If you're trying to be a professional, I recommend you kill that dream real quick. If you want it to be a hobby, go ahead. I know plenty of 5'4" people in the parks that are crushing it. You just got to be a little realistic, though. And it's easy to be realistic when you understand that every single human out there, we all have a gift. Something comes so easy to us that others are shocked. And you will be able to spot a talent when different people who do not know each other are all giving you the same compliments. They're like, how do you do that? Or who taught you that? And you will overlook this. Despite them giving you a compliment, you're just going to be like, it's not a big deal. It is a big deal, okay? Spotting your talent is one of the hardest things to do because it requires experimentation and it requires introspection. A lot of people experiment a lot, but they never introspect, so they never learn from their experiences. And a lot of people introspect a lot, but they don't have that many experiences, so they're just doing a lot of these thought experiments that don't tie into reality. When you have a lot of experiences and you actually take the time to reflect back on those experiences, what happens is eventually you begin to find your calling and you start to see, wait a minute, this, I'm really good at this. This is something that interests me. And this is something I'm willing to learn the rules about. You have the talent. It could be a hobby and you have the desire to learn the skills. That is how you find your calling. And finding your calling is a very difficult thing. But once you do it, I recommend you double down on it. If this gentleman from earlier that I was talking about was a great dancer and he was taking the time to actually learn about the field, he would have been crushing it in the internet age. I mean, this was in 2012. So this is when the internet was somewhat rudimentary. I mean, YouTube and Facebook, these were still being experimental technologies. Nowadays, I mean, if he's teaching people how to dance, maybe before a wedding or before a fraternity stroll competition, he'd get a lot of views. That could lead to mainstream success. Unfortunately, though, he just did not like his talent at all. And eventually, he grew tired of it. And if you are someone that is growing somewhat tired of your talent, maybe you're a great cook or you're a great impromptu speaker or you're a great dancer, and you're just growing somewhat tired of it, here's a trick I will give you. Learn about the history of the field. Because when you learn about the history, it just makes you appreciate the field way more. Because a while back, I was writing this book called The Prolific Writer. And you should definitely check out the book. The Prolific Writer teaches you about creative writing skills and how to create content on autopilot and build your digital brand. You could grab a copy on ArmaniTalks.com, hit shop, and find it there. As I was writing Prolific Writer, there came a certain point where I thought, okay, it's a little too short. I need one more section that will make it the perfect size. What am I going to add on? So I started to learn more and more and more about creative writing. I spent the next couple of months just writing about writing, you see? And eventually I was able to crystallize the history of writing, which was so freaking fascinating. I mean, we didn't always have a pencil. We didn't always have a pen. Before, what people would do was they would have like these wet cinder blocks and they'd have a very sharp utensil that they'd mark on the cinder blocks and wait for it to dry. That was their version of writing. And later on, what happened was people would have these feathers with the little quills, then they would dip it in ink, then they would write. But imagine this. Imagine that you have a creative idea and you're trying to get it out there. And each time you're trying to get it out there, you have to get this feather, dip it in ink, and then write. Then the ink dries up. You got to dip it again, then write. This is painfully tedious. And eventually what happens is that you're like, what was my idea again? You just lost motivation. That's why the first ever information technology breakthrough was the pen. That is the one that connected the writing instrument with the ink. So you didn't have to keep doing this dip motion. Once you got rid of this dip motion, you could just get your ideas out there quick. After that, I mean, obviously, the history writes itself. I mean, now you could type and it's easy. But if I'm just over here just typing and not understanding the history behind what is allowing me to type, then I'm going to take this for granted. So when I learned the history of writing, nowadays, whenever I write with pride. I write and think, wow, my ideas are being heard around the world. You see? And this is powerful. So if you are someone that is growing tired of your talent, you really need to take the time to learn the history of your field. And once you learn the history of your field, you're going to learn another thing. Learning history is one of the funnest things you can do that will help you reduce your anxiety. When you are consuming history and you're learning more about the past, you'll make a couple of fascinating realizations. The first realization you'll make is that, whoa, my ancient ancestors weren't dumb. I don't know about you, but for me, when I used to think of history, I'm like, what can I possibly learn from these people? They were savages. They didn't know that much. They didn't even have the internet. That's what I actually thought. Then I started to consume a lot of these autobiographies and books from the past. And I started to see that fundamentally, a lot of human experiences always are the same, which means that a lot of the problems are the same. There's betrayal. There's joy. There's too much joy where you keep stacking up wins and you get complacent. And then life hands you an L. As I'm reading this, I'm thinking, wait a minute. Stuff from the past can easily be applied to the present. So these guys from the past, they're not dumb. They're smart in a completely different way. That was one insight I made. And once I saw a lot of the times that people were going through identical problems in a different field that I was going through right now, I just felt less anxious. I thought, oh, wait, this isn't only happening to me. One of the reasons that a lot of people get anxious is because we do a thing called personalize the problems. Whenever something happens to us, we're like, it only happens to us. And I'll give you an example. You know, a couple of days ago, I went to Walmart and I was, this was one of those Walmarts where they have the self-checkout lines and there was no one that was actually checking you out. So you were being forced to do the self-checkout. Normally, I don't mind this, but on this particular day, there were so many freaking people in Walmart. And most of these people, whenever they do the self-checkout thing, they're slow. So slow. And it's annoying when you see that their shopping cart is packed. I'm waiting for a long time. And eventually, the lady in front of me, she's going so freaking slow. Like, it seems as though she's kind of looking at me like, well, you're not going to rush me. I'm going to take my sweet time. She is. I'm waiting and waiting away. Eventually, I put in my headphones and I'm watching a YouTube video as I'm holding my cart. And as I'm doing this, eventually, there's this guy that's like getting very close to cutting me, right? And I'm looking up thinking that he's kind of getting pushed out of his lane because it's so packed. Then I look up and he's just like actually mumbling some words to me. So I take out my headphones. I'm like, yo, what's up? He says, I could cut, right? I could cut. I was like, nah, man, I've been waiting. He's like, come on, bro. I just got one thing, Pedialyte. He's talking in the slang words. I can't even barely understand him. It's like, all right, man, go ahead. Because I didn't want to make a big fuss about it. It's just one item. So eventually he's over here getting in front of me and he's scanning it. He's scanning it in a very sloppy way, so it's not hitting. And at this point, I'm already low in patience. I'm like, hurry up, bro. Come on, let's go, let's go. And he's scanning it. He finally gets it. He pulls out his card. He's trying to pay. And they're not letting him pay with the this card. So now he has to call one of the ladies over. And at this point, I could have already been done. I only had 5 items. And I'm a really fast checking out kind of person. So he's over here like, hey, lady, lady. And she's helping someone else. And I'm just having my time wasted. My arm is getting sore from holding this cart for so freaking long. And I'm just thinking, man, if I just told him no when he wanted to cut me, then I could have been out of here by now. I didn't, though. And I'm over here waiting. And then finally, the lady comes and the lady's like, sir, this particular thing doesn't take this card. I was like, okay. He's like, okay, then what do I do? He's like, well, it won't take this card, sir. Sorry, it won't work. And now he's like finally leaving and I could pay for my items. At this point, though, I'm thinking, man, dude, I should have literally just said, no, man, you shouldn't have cut. He only did that to me. Then what I see is he starts to go to another line and he goes to another line and he's like, sir, can I please cut? I only have 1 item. And then the guy's like, all right, go ahead. So when I was personalizing the problem and saying that it was only happening to me, I was feeling a lot of angst and anger. But when I saw that it was happening to other people as well, that's when I felt a level of composure. And that's what history does for people. A lot of the times, whenever you are consuming content, you begin to see that everyone has some sort of problems. One of the best books I can give you for autobiographies is Will Chamberlain's autobiography. I've mentioned it in the past, and one of the reasons I mentioned it is because it begins to teach you that no human has the perfect life. On a surface level, he's this 7-foot tall multi-millionaire, has a new girl every single day of the week, is great at his sport. You would be thinking that this guy gets nothing but praise. However, that's not the case. Instead, he's labeled a loser. I mean, he'll go to different family gatherings and everyone will ask him why he keeps losing to this gentleman named Bill Russell. The media constantly harasses him. The media calls him just a bum. Despite him being so freaking talented and gifted in so many parts of his life, this guy is highly insecure. If you read his book, you could just tell that this is an insecure man that is going out of his way to just market himself so he can prove to the world that he is not a loser. And it just helps you empathize with people a little bit more, especially these people that you think have it all figured out. You'll look at them and you'll think, this guy has all the money. This guy has a beautiful wife, has an amazing house. He has everything figured out. But what you don't know is that his kids hate him. He's on the verge of getting fired any day now, and he's always just working with that angst. He's living paycheck to paycheck. You don't know about that because all you see are the surface level stuff. Don't judge so soon. And reading these books, I mean, it will honestly help you. And different people get curious about reading at different stages. If you do want to get curious about reading, I recommend that you start off with whatever you are curious about. And see, this is where a lot of these conservative content creators make a big mistake. I've been realizing as of late how delusional a lot of these conservative guys are. Last year was a year of dissing the liberals. I'm like, man, these guys are, they don't have any rules. While the conservatives, they have too many rules. And one of them I've noticed is to consistently make fun of fiction or any form of art. Anytime they see a certain kind of art, they have this highly practical lens that they view the art from. They don't quite understand the subjective experiences that humans feel. So they're just like, what's the point? And if you tell them that you're going to read a fiction book to ease yourself back into reading, they're going to laugh at you. They're going to be like, why the heck are you doing something like that? You should be reading nonfiction. Not true. Reading fiction to get back into reading is one of the easiest ways to do it. That's when you realize that, wait, reading can be fun. That's all you want to learn. And people sometimes wonder, why am I going to read when I have TikToks, radio, YouTube, all these different other channels? You want to know why? It's because whenever you consume anything on the TV, that's what I call passive engagement. But whenever you read, that's called active engagement. So for the TV, let's say you're watching a superhero movie. What happens is that you are being presented the images that the film director chose for you. You are passively consuming the content. On the flip side, if you are reading a superhero book, what's happening is that your brain is being forced to turn words into moving images. And do not undermine how powerful this is. This is you using your imagination for productivity rather than for destructive purposes. A lot of reasons people have anxiety is because they have zero control of their imagination. They just imagine whatever and they just leave it at that. And these people also don't know the difference between thinking and wandering, where wandering is when you're just hopping from thought to thought to thought. And thinking is something that has a purpose behind it. One easy way to build that thinking muscle is to read fiction every now and then, because fiction forces you to use your imagination more than nonfiction. Now, I'm not saying discard nonfiction. I have the 3-to-1 rule. So for every 3 nonfiction books you read, you should read 1 fiction. And this is just a very simple framework that will allow you to work on the critical thinking part of your brain along with the imagination. And once you can combine these two hemispheres, you become a better storyteller. In my book, The Art and Science of Storytelling, which you can currently get on Amazon, just type in Art and Science of Storytelling, Armani Talks. One thing that I talk about is that a storyteller has to have universal knowledge. You never know when certain info that you deemed silly can come in beneficial later on. And when you have a wide variety of content that you consume, that's when you can create content about anything. And more importantly, you can package your experiences in an appropriate way in order to engage the audience. One reason that a lot of you guys struggle with ideas is because you guys don't consume enough. You guys differentiate creating versus consuming. You're like, well, I'm a creator now. The consumption stage is done. And then you make fun of anyone that is consuming. Not good. To be a great creator, you always need to be consuming. Okay? You should actually be consuming more than you're creating, because if you actually know the frameworks for how to create, it's not going to take you that long once you understand which topics to talk about. Consuming is what I call lifelong learning. As long as you're lifelong learning, you're always going to have different ideas to create on. This is actually a rule that Pixar follows. For Pixar, what they do is whenever they're trying to create these worlds, what they do is they find similarities in the real world that resembles the imaginary world, and they'll spend a long time just living there, absorbing the culture, learning more about it. So by the time they come back into the animation studio, these ideas are morphed with their imagination to create something brand new. Now, if they skipped the absorbing stage, then it's going to require way more head power. It's going to be so difficult. But if they consumed, they learned, they read, I would say even then, like TikToks and stuff, they could be used strategically if you have some sort of content creation vehicle. The reason that TikTok and a lot of these social media apps seem like a waste of time for most people is because they don't create any form of content at all. It's sort of like going to the gym and you have zero desire to improve your body. Now it's as though all of these different gym items, they're lacking uniformity. It's just a bunch of random items rather than items that can help you go from point A, body type, to point B, body type. Improving your body type is important, and that is when you will see that, okay, I understand for myself that I need to improve how I look. And now when you go to the gym, you know how to ask the different people questions. You know how to use certain items, how to lift certain weights, and how to show perseverance. And it's the same thing with storytelling, where if you have some sort of content creation vehicle, whether it's journaling, whether it's private YouTube channel, public YouTube channel, a podcast, etc., it will help you out tremendously. With that being said, one thing to understand is that a lot of these people that are creating content online, what they're really doing is they're journaling and they're chronicling their journey out loud. And it's important not to take every single thing that you hear on social media as an end-all be-all for what to do. And I'll give you an example of this. Recently, I was watching this one creator creates content on how to be an alpha male. I think he's 25 or 26. And I think that's a little too young to know what the heck an alpha male is. And when you're that young and your identity revolves around creating content on being an alpha male, what happens is that you begin to try to be something that you're not. So this guy, like, he's always talking about how to lift weights, how to, like, you know, flirt with girls, how to be a macho man. And recently, he was on this train about how he wanted to get married and have kids. He found the perfect person who wanted the same things as him. They moved to the middle of nowhere. And as they had their relationship for some time, what happened next was he realized that's not the life that he wanted. He said that he still wanted to explore and have fun. So him and this girl ended up breaking up. And his audience was shocked. "Why the heck did you two break up?" they asked. And initially, this creator didn't answer the question. He just kept ignoring it until his comment sections were flooded with that same question on why the heck did you break up. And eventually, he made a video on why they broke up. And one of the lessons he stated was, you know, he's being an alpha male all the time. And then once he's in a relationship, every now and then he's being silly. And he believed when he was being silly, it killed the attraction, and eventually everything went downhill from there. And then he tops it off with, "Young men, never be silly around your girl." I heard that, and immediately I thought something about that advice didn't feel right. And later on, I realized what the issue was. One thing that people don't talk about with content creation is that if your topics really revolve around a certain subject, eventually it's going to color your perception and it's going to influence who you are. One of the examples is in Sopranos. The main character who played that Tony Soprano guy, I've never watched the movie. I've just seen interviews after about the guy. He said that it took a psychological hit on his life to play that character because that character was so freaking evil. Killing people, being a thug, all of that. And this guy was such a brilliant actor. So for him to get into that role, eventually seasons started to build on up. I mean, The Sopranos is known as one of the greatest shows of all time. So there are multiple seasons. So there's multiple seasons of this guy acting like a straight up thug. Eventually it begins to permeate his natural life. And he said after each scene, he had to take this shower to just wash away the demons. I'm thinking, man, like, this guy is not able to see the distinction. Reality is actually getting blurred. And that's exactly what happened with this alpha male creator. He's starting to create so much content on alpha male that once he closes his laptop, he's going to his girl like, "Hey there, sweetheart." And he's acting like this character that he's created on the internet. And every now and then, that mask is going to fall off and he's going to be his real self. So I believe the takeaway that he got was, young men, put on the mask tighter. But I believe the real lesson was, know when to take the mask off so your partner gets the real you. Because you could put up an act for so long. Eventually, it's going to get draining. And the thing is, whenever you're with someone for a long time, they're going to discover more about you. It's like a roommate. I remember one of the times I ended up rooming with one of my best friends, and he kept telling me, "Oh, Armani, I am one of the cleanest guys out there." We move in together. The first 2 weeks, he's able to pull the charade. But later on, he starts to do these little things where I'm like, a clean person wouldn't even do something like that. Like, leave the plate on the table after you're done eating. Dude, a clean person will wash it immediately. So now I'm starting to see, wait a minute, you're not really clean. By 6 month mark, I knew for a fact he wasn't clean. So if you think that you're going to be in one of these long-term relationships and you're always going to have this mask on, that's not realistic. That's not me saying, like, go in front of your partner and always be silly or don't improve at all. I'm saying improve, right? But what you need to do is you need to showcase your authentic personality to your other half. And the way that you find your authentic personality is to see how you act with people that you are comfortable with. Just make that observation. I mean, right now, who are you comfortable with? Your brother? Okay, how do you act with your brother? And you'll see that there are certain fragments of your personality that are consistent with people that you are comfortable with. Those fragments are the real you. That's you without the mask. Because I get it. Like, with this alpha male guy, I don't judge him at all for putting up this certain persona online. If you create content online, one thing that you're going to understand is that it requires a certain level of showmanship. If you're just kind of like speaking like this the whole time, like you're having this chill conversation with a friend, that's not going to work. You're not going to enunciate. When you record yourself, what happens is that a lot of your presence gets digitized, and there's a thing called the drop-off rate, where a lot of your impact is being lost simply due to the fact that you're being digitized. So do not be surprised when you see a lot of these YouTubers that you watch in real life, and you're like, whoa, this guy is pretty tall. This guy has this big, brash personality. I couldn't tell that on screen, right? Because a lot of the personality is being lost. So if you know that a lot of the personality is being lost due to the digital drop-off rate, you need to amp it up just a little bit. So that's where like a lot of these alter egos and whatever come from. But then there's another layer. Let's say you're talking about a topic that you need to get a hard stance on. There's not much nuance in your content. Suddenly, you're pretty much warping your thinking patterns to think black and white. Gray thinking, which is thinking that is actually aligned with reality, especially individual experiences, are being discarded. One mistake that a lot of people make in the internet is that they talk a little too much about generalities, and they're like, well, generalities are how societies work, right? So why are we going to talk about the exceptions? The reason that this is not the smart way to think is because, yes, this is how societies work, but on a day-by-day experiential level, you're not always going by societal thinking. You're going by individual thinking, and individual thinking requires gray. But these content creators, they had to take a certain stance, and they're programming their mind after each and every single upload to think black and white. So nowadays, when they're trying to interact with the world, they're having to unlearn a lot of the things that their career revolves around. It is a big mess. That's why it's very important when you're creating content to not act too much like a cartoon character online, because it will have an impact on your real life. Not all money is good money. A long time ago, there was this one period when I was doing affiliate marketing, more specifically global affiliate marketing, and I was pretty much buying ads on different websites and trying to promote products. In the beginning, I was trying to make people download wallpapers and video games. And I was on this forum. I think it's called STM, Stack That Money Forum. I was paying like $90 a month for it. And eventually, I was doing a thing called an FA, follow along, as I was chronicling my journey. And I kept talking about how I was losing money with affiliate marketing. Eventually, one of the head contributors were like, hey, dude, the reason you're losing money is because you're in a dying niche. No one gets wallpapers anymore. You need to switch to adult. You know what adult is? Porn. X-rated content, right? So what happened was, and this was a long time ago, by the way, but what happened back then was to make people download a certain porn clip or whatever was a very lucrative business. So now I'm over here having to create these display ads where, okay, this is actually like weird to even explain. I'm basically creating these display ads that makes people want to click, okay? And your display ad needs to be different because once they click, now they're redirected to that landing page where they could download the offer. And once they download the offer, you get the sell. Your main job is to create that banner that makes people want to click. And you know how someone finds a banner like that? They got to actually watch porn, right? And then look for the perfect scene. Like, aha, this is the scene. So what would happen was I would have this long day of work. Then I would come back and I would have to watch these clips of porn, right? And then I'm like, okay, no, this scene sucks. This scene sucks. This scene sucks. Oh, this scene. Boom. This scene may work. And that's a key phrase. May. It may work. So you don't know. So you got to get four of these different images. You got to put it in your ad generator. And it's going to all populate on different websites. And then you're going to engineer and see which of the ads were the highest performing. That was the role. So I was making money, but it's what I call blood money. And afterwards, like after I shut my laptop off, my roommates were chilling in the living room. They're talking to me. I'm like, oh man, bro, I don't even want to talk right now. I am mentally burnt out. And eventually, I just realized, man, the money and stuff, it's not worth it. It doesn't matter if they pay me $5,000 a day. I do not want to scope through porn to find four images. And here's the thing, the product that I'm even selling, it's not a product that's benefiting society in any way. It's a way for other guys to consume more porn. So these are mental models that you actually need to take some time to iron out, especially when you are creating content, because sometimes you will be presented with a situation where you are making money, but the way that you're making money is in a very corrupt, soul-crushing sort of way. And other times you're not making that much money, but you're constantly getting messages saying, wow, man, like you're really helping me in my life. And this is a very hard decision to make because we still have bills to pay. We still need to function in society. Money is very important. Don't let any of these guys tell you otherwise. Money is very important. So decisions must be made. And now you really need to evaluate your moral compass. Creating content online is one of the toughest things to do. In the beginning, it seems easy when a lot of these platforms are on your side. But eventually what begins to happen is that platforms aren't on your side. Things that were working years ago are no longer working. And rather than just losing your composure, what are you going to do? You have to be able to adjust. And that's why we need to develop some sort of a philosophy. How does one create a philosophy? You can consume a lot of the religious books out there. I think that's a great way to get started. You could consume any book out there that, like I know some guys, like they consume a lot of these Stoicism books and it helps them cultivate a philosophy. Ultimately though, it's not just about consuming alone. You need to be able to solve problems and a lot of disparate problems, right? Where the problems, they don't seem like they're intertwining, but you're just solving it randomly. Like, let's say your cousin is cheating on your best friend. Do you tell the best friend that your cousin is cheating on them? This is a problem that requires a lot of ironing out of your philosophy to resolve, or are you just going to ignore it? Another example could be you are presented a situation where you could make a lot of money, but you're doing something that feels icky. Do you do it? Yes or no? Completely disparate problem. One of your friends asks you for a loan and he's a very unreliable friend. Do you give him the loan or not? So after solving a bunch of these problems, what begins to happen is that even though they seemed disparate in the beginning stages, over time, you start to see this invisible thread that's connecting all these problems. And that's when you are having what I call a practical philosophy. Because you look at a lot of these guys, man, and when they talk about philosophy, they're sitting on their butt and they're just talking a lot. Oh, that's not materialism, that's realism, blah, blah, blah. All these different phrases. My thing is, well, what the heck are you doing with all this? Philosophy and engineering are not that different, especially in the real world. Philosophy leads to engineering, and engineering helps you put more faith in your philosophy. So if you're one of these guys that's not solving any problems, you're just reading a lot of philosophy books, you're not going to get the most out of philosophy. There comes a time and place when we really have to understand how to think appropriately. And that's why I always recommend to my audience, learn how to write. Okay, learn how to write, learn how to speak, learn how to listen, learn how to like look at things. Because a lot of these guys, they act like they have great observation skills, but they really don't. They get in the habit of missing the context so many times, and trying to explain the context to someone is like trying to explain a joke to someone. I actually had a moment like this in my past when, you know, I was one time, you know, matched up with this one girl who just moved from Bangladesh to the US. And overall, I mean, she seemed like a cool person and all. The one big red flag was that we would talk, she would always hear stuff, but I don't know if she would listen. And one of the examples was, one day I'm over here going for a walk. It begins to rain a lot midway into the walk. So I can't really go back. So I'm thinking about finishing off my walk. I'm walking some more. And eventually what happens is that I slip on this wet, muddy area. I fall. I scrape my knee. It hurts so bad. And I'm in pain. And I'm pretty much limping back to my place. Eventually, the girl hits me up and she's like, "Hey, Arman, how's your day going? How come you didn't message back for a while?" I explained the situation, right? I was going for a walk, then I slipped. I fell because it was raining a lot. And she's like, I'm thinking she's understanding. Now, a couple of days goes on by and she's like, "Hey, Arman, are you still falling?" Wait a minute. Am I still falling? What do you mean, am I still falling? Why are you framing it like I'm this old man that is losing control of his limbs before his very eyes? That is not the context that I fell. I fell because I slipped. So what do you mean, are you still falling? And she didn't get it. All she heard was, I fell. And after that, she just kind of let her imagination do the rest. And that is what I mean when contexts are missed. And contexts are going to be missed. That's why communication issues happen in the first place. It's because sometimes we mean a certain thing, but a person gets a completely different interpretation. That's why it's very important when the information is important enough to have them repeat it. Hey, buddy, can you just explain what you heard from your own lens? Because when you confront someone or you give someone a complex task, a lot of the times they will just tell you what you want to hear. They'll remember a few key phrases, right, while their mind is in La La Land, and then they'll repeat those key phrases back to you. And from there, they fool you into thinking that they understood your message. But when you say, look, hey, can you just explain to me what you understood? You'll be shocked because a lot of the times they didn't understand it at all. One time I told my virtual assistant, hey, bro, can you post these threads? Each book needs to be different for the week. And he says, yes. And I made the mistake of not having him explain what is the project. So he basically posts a bunch of chapters from the same book. I said, no, bro, I wanted it from different books. So each book is getting promoted. And he's like, oh, okay, my bad. You don't want to do this too much though. If you're just saying, hey, bro, can you give me some water? They're like, okay. And you're like, what did I just tell you to do? They'll be like, what the hell is wrong with you, dude? So you don't want to overdo it. But whenever something is important enough, you want to ask them like, hey, what did you get from what I just said? Can you explain it back to me? And every now and then, if it's really important, you actually want to give them certain thought experiments in regards to this. Let's say you are not comfortable with your partner eating bad food, right? Or bringing bad food into the household because you don't want your kids to be surrounded by that. So you don't want them to bring like bacon, chips, sweets, etc. And you say this, you say that this is very important, and the partner says, sounds good. That's not enough. So you ask, well, what did you get from this? And they say, you said not to bring unhealthy food in front of the kids. And you're like, okay, well, this is still something, but I don't know if she completely understands what I'm talking about. So you give a thought experiment. How about X, Y, and Z? Would you bring these? And she says, well, yeah, I mean, I'd bring these. You're like, no, 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 you can't bring this because this has hydrogenated oils. I don't want any food like that with hydrogenated oils in the household. Now it's through the thought experiment, you're helping them understand, really, rather than repeating something back to you. So the thought experiment thing does come in clutch, but you really want to pick and choose your battles. Because if you keep giving people thought experiments and you're not allowing them to use their own judgment, eventually what happens is that they view you as a micromanager and you view them as someone who needs micromanaging. You don't trust their judgment. So it's very important that whenever these conversations are big enough, you pick this as the battle that you want to articulate out loud more. And that's when you have them explaining their side to you and you give them these thought experiments and ask them, well, what do you think? That's very important. What do you think? Because that's a very subjective question that brings a lot of spotlight back on them. And another way to deal with non-confrontational people is to ask them, what does your ideal situation look like? Okay? Because sometimes it's difficult because you're over here thinking that everything is good, but someone may be feeling a certain type of way. And unless you notice it, that's number one, or you bring up like, okay, so what does your ideal situation look like? Then they may say yes to a decision that they are completely against. And later on, what happens is that they tell you, right? Like birthday parties. I mean, this happens with birthday parties all the time where I don't celebrate my birthday, but undergrad, there was like within our friends group, there was, I guess, a girl that really wanted to go to this outdoor spot for her birthday. But there was another girl within the same friend group that was like, oh no, I don't like that spot because the bouncer is very mean. So that girl whose birthday it's not ends up convincing us to go somewhere else. And I guess the birthday girl felt a certain type of way. So the girl who didn't want to go to the outside bar or whatever should have told the birthday girl, look, I really can't go. Like, is there any ideal situation that we can both work out? That ideal situation thing really allows people to feel at ease. And another version of this is every now and then we have to give people advice that we don't want to give. And one of the questions you want to ask right before you give this very stinging advice is, do you want the real answer or do you want me to sugarcoat it? Now, if they're any person with pride, they're not going to be like, yo, give me the sugarcoated version, mister. They're going to be like, no, 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 give me the real thing. So they're stating that they want the real thing. And they feel as though that there's this bridge between you now because you asked. See, the problem is when you are delivering scathing advice to someone who didn't ask, who doesn't remotely care about your opinion, and you'd never ask them, like, do you mind if I sugarcoat it or not? But let's say they do come. They're like, dude, man, this relationship is just not working out. What do you think? And you ask the question now, like, do you want the real answer or do you want me to sugarcoat it? And you give the real answer after they said, no, no, I could handle the real thing. They'll appreciate you for it. So people, they're not always against tough love. A lot of people that you think are a little too sensitive, they're probably sensitive because they don't, at this stage of their life, or with this particular field, they don't respect your opinion in regards to this. Like, hypothetically, if you don't run a business and you're telling a businessman how to run their business, they may get annoyed and you may reach the conclusion that this person is sensitive. Like, oh man, this guy just can't handle criticism. But this guy, from his perspective, is thinking, who are you to give me any sort of criticism on this topic when you work a 9-to-5 job and you never started your own business? Never. You don't have one single business that you could even say that you failed at to give me advice on this field. So you're thinking that they're sensitive, but they're thinking you're a moron. Another example of this is when people without kids start to give advice to people with kids. I didn't know this was a thing until one day I'm going on my Instagram and my barber, he's going on like these heated stories, like one after another after another. He's like, if you don't have kids, I don't want you to tell me how to raise mine. I was like, dang, man, like this guy's getting heated. Later on, when I went to get my haircut from him, I found out that him and his child's mother, they're not together. So she chills with him sometimes. And a lot of his friends criticize his parenting styles. And maybe there are things to criticize. But he's also viewing it as, well, who the hell are you to criticize me? You don't even have kids. So you really got to know who you are giving advice to. Because if someone didn't ask you for your advice and you're just giving them advice anyways, you just want to put yourself in their shoes. What if someone is doing that to you? What if, it's one thing if you're competent in the field, but even then, people who are competent in a field giving advice to someone else who didn't ask for it, the person who didn't ask for it will feel a certain type of way with someone who's competent. So imagine if the person is not competent in the field. Imagine how they're going to feel. Imagine how you are going to feel. So these are certain things in social skills that we want to keep in mind, where a lot of the times we will have the right answer. And rather than forcing our right answer onto their current experience levels, you let them go through those experiences and extract whatever lessons they can. And then when they come back to you and ask you for advice, you can really hammer home the lessons to them. Another thing that I want to end the episode on, this is very important, is that different people are always in different stages of their self-improvement journey. You may have been one of those guys that started journaling in 2019, but let's say your little brother just started picking it up in 2024. When he tells you that, hey, big bro, I'm journaling, you may be very tempted to kill his vibe a lot of times. You may say, well, I started journaling in 2019. Or you may be like, all right, make sure you journal like this, not like this. Oh, you're just hearing about it? You may be very condescending in regards to it, while you don't want to do that. Instead, you want to say, yo, congratulations, man. Journaling is a great way for you to clear your mind. It's fun. If you ever have any questions, let me know, because I've been doing it for some time. But yeah, let me know how it goes for your process. I'm curious to learn more about things that you discover in your journaling journey. And that requires a lot of restraint, especially when you have been doing it. You see, it's kind of like you know a certain piece of gossip and someone is coming to you super enthusiastic and they really, really want to tell you this story. And if you just kill their vibe and you're like, I know, they're going to think, okay, well, there's still so much energy. I still kind of want to say it. Where it requires restraint for you to know, but you can spot that this person really wants to share the story. So you're like, no, go ahead, tell me. Okay, so this requires restraint. And a lot of people in communication skills, they lack the restraint. And due to them lacking the restraint, they just create enemies for no reason. Avoid saying, I know so much. Sometimes let people repeat a story around you. Sometimes laugh a little bit when someone says a joke that's not funny, but you're capable of spotting that they were trying to make you laugh. And other times, I mean, when you see someone picking up a habit that you started 5 to 6 years ago, quit making yourself the star of the show. Quit saying when you started the habit and all the things you learned. Allow the spotlight to be on them. What made you pick up this habit? What have you learned thus far? What are your future plans with this habit? Be like that, my friend. And the more that you take the spotlight off of you at times, the more charismatic that you feel in the long run, the bigger that you feel. And the bigger that you feel, charisma is something that happens as a byproduct. So we are wrapping up today's talk. And if you enjoyed it so far, you definitely want to hear a couple of things. The ArmaniTalks.com website has all my different items, my blogs, my videos, my podcasts, my content in general, my services, all in one page. So if you made it this far, maybe a part of you is curious about the Armani Talks brand, the message, etc. And one of the easiest ways to learn more about the brand is to go on ArmaniTalks.com. If you're really curious about the brand, on the top right corner, there's going to be a button called newsletter. You could click that newsletter button, put in your email, and subscribe to the Armani Talks Free Daily Newsletter. I am completely aware that it is so difficult to read a book from front to back nowadays. We're just bombarded with so many different messages. And what the Armani Talks newsletter does is that it allows you to still read, but read without allocating too much time. Most of the newsletters are roughly 500 to 600 words, and they deal with topics on public speaking, discipline, emotional resilience, and creativity, how to tell stories better, how to be more charismatic, many topics that you should have learned in school, but unfortunately, they did not teach you in school. You will learn that in the Armani Talks free daily newsletter. Subscribe, level up your communication skills. And the more that you level up your communication skills, the more that you can share your message with the world. Thank you very much for joining the Armani Talks show, and I will catch you next time, my friend. Stay safe.